Good morning. It's time for the Estate and Medicaid Planning Hour with the Herzog Law Firm.
Will you still need me? Will you still feed me when I'm 64?
And good morning. I'm Dave Kubikin.
Good morning. I'm Dan Glasser.
Dan and I are two of the attorneys at the Herzog Law Firm, and some configuration of the attorneys at Herzog Law Firm are here every weekend talking about things like estate planning and elder law, real estate, powers of attorney, healthcare proxies, trusts, and everything in between. Every now and then we get into a discussion about baseball, which I think we might do today. We have offices in Albany, Kingston, Clifton Park, and Saratoga Springs, and you could be our first, second, third caller by calling 518-476-5900. Good morning, Dan. What's going on?
Good morning, Dave. I had a rough night. I'm a big hockey fan. My Islanders, their season ended last night.
Well, what a season it was, though. Please, you know, not everyone can win the Stanley Cup, and it's pretty good to be in the semifinals, right?
It is.
Game seven.
Last time they got this far, I was 5 years old. I remember it like it was yesterday.
I remember, Dan, so we're both from Long Island, right? I remember going to an Islanders-Rangers playoff game. I think it was like a first-round game. And I heard words I'd never heard before. Let's just put it that way.
I don't know what word you're talking about, but...
So right before we started, Ben, yourself and myself, we were talking about Boston because I happen to be in Boston right now, and I'm sitting in my car. Kudos to COVID, by the way, for allowing something like this to happen where I could be not in a studio, not even in Albany and talking to you guys. But I'm in Cambridge, which is where Harvard is, and it's very beautiful, as you would probably suspect. And I'm staring at this beautiful, you know, square and this church. And then what happened? A Sam Adams truck rolled by. And I was like, this is the most Boston thing I could think of in my brain. Because wow. I don't know that much about Boston.
And now you're thirsty.
Yeah. And I did a pilgrimage just for Ben. I did drive by Fenway.
Thank you. I appreciate that. Very nice.
I chugged a beer right there for you.
Thank you. I love it.
Yeah. Dan, how are you?
Dave,
I'm ready for your big trip here.
I am. I'm going away on vacation. I'm excited. I have not been away in a while.
I know you're going away. I'm sorry, Dan. Go ahead.
I was saying I haven't been away in a while, which I'm sure is the case with many people out there, given what we went through. But
absolutely. Well, you know, I'm here because of a christening, and so it's nice to know that christenings are happening again. My son was born 2 years ago, and hopefully he'll be baptized sometime this summer. That's the plan now. The joke is he's going to be able to undress himself and walk into the water by himself at this point since he's so old. But it's nice to know that these big events are starting to happen and more people are getting those shots in their arms, which is great news for sure. The reason why I know you're going away, Dan, is because for the first time in a long time, I'm going to be handling the closing for you. And maybe that's a good place for us to start this weekend.
Yes, and thank you for the coverage. I am grateful.
No problem. The whole point of this was just to try to get that response from you. So a thank you from you was well worth it.
There it is.
So I don't know much about the transaction, and before people start to call their bar association and say these guys have no idea what they're doing, you've done just about all the work. I'm literally going to be the person at the closing reviewing documents, making sure all the numbers add up, and explaining documents to clients. I've done, you know, hundreds of closings before, but I'm not a real estate attorney. You are.
Right.
So can you get into all the work you've done to set it up so I can look good on Tuesday.
Yeah, I mean, our number one goal is to make sure that our covering attorney looks great. So you're all set there. So we do. We prepare all the documents ahead of time. They get reviewed. We send numbers to the client ahead of time so that there's no surprise at the closing, like what is this fee? Where did this number come from? And the idea is to make the closing enjoyable so that there's no stress or no drama. I always give the client a heads up because the client and I have been talking probably for about 2 months about their file, going back and forth about various things, and then all of a sudden I'm not there at the closing, and they're wondering, well, where's Dan? So I let them know, and I do an intro email, like, dear client, meet Dave. He's going to be at the closing. Any questions you have ahead of time, now you have his contact info. Don't hesitate to call. And always give a reminder to the client, like your closing is scheduled for Friday at 10 a.m. at this location. Always tell them what to bring, which is usually a valid, non-expired form of photo ID. The face mask rule, offices have different policies, so I have clients bring it just in case. And let them know what to expect. You know, some people think the closing is going to be a few hours, which is not the case. Generally, it's about an hour. Some are less, some are more. And then, you know, you were about to say something, and I interrupted.
Yeah, I was going to. I was about to interrupt you, and then you interrupted me interrupting you, which is par for the course. So, you know, there's a lot of documents that get signed at a closing. And depending on who you are, the seller or the buyer, you may have a lot more documents to sign than the other person. And in general, like if you're the seller, there's a lot less to be explained, a lot less to sign. If you're the buyer and you're getting financing, oh boy, right? We got a stack of documents. Sometimes it's triplicate when it comes to the mortgage and so on. Normal, like my expectation is for Tuesday, and it's weird that we're talking about this on the radio, but it's good to talk about it. I'm prepared to go through every single document because I've done these closings before. I know you go through every single document, and I know you always are miffed at the idea that other real estate attorneys or other attorneys pretending to be a real estate attorney just say sign here, just say here you go, and they don't really go into the documents.
That is true. A bit of a pet peeve of mine because, as you said, whether you're selling or buying, you know, as the seller, there's not a lot to do after you're done signing, but just watch the buyer sign their paperwork. So sometimes I'm just, you know, looking at the other attorney, watching them or listening to them explain documents. And yes, there are some that just say, just sign it right here without even explaining what it is. Now, granted, if they don't sign it, they're not getting the house. They're not going to close. But I still think that the client should know what they're signing so that they don't leave the closing room thinking, what did I just do? What am I now obligated to? And yes, explaining documents takes time. And I've gotten, over the years, I've gotten looks from other attorneys as if to say, they're in a hurry, move it along, I need to get out of here, which only makes me go slower. I just think it's important to go through, you know, everything and, you know, make it enjoyable for the client. I know it's stressful with everything going on, but you know, I want their questions answered, so I take my time.
As you should. Look, it's a legal transaction. It's for most people, just about all people, it's going to be the largest legal transaction they're gonna do. And you know, you want to know what you're buying. You want to know what you're obligated to do. You know, those mortgages are long. There's all sorts of provisions in there. You know, there are provisions in a mortgage document that will say that upon a certain event, all the money that you just borrowed is owed.
Right.
You kind of know what that event is, right? I mean, that being said, you know, I usually will ask a buyer, is this the first time you're buying a house? When's the last time you had a closing? And if they're, you know, if they're buying a summer house and this is their, you know, the third time they've bought a property or sold a property, and they know, you know, I don't need to start from square one, and you know, I'll offer them a shorter version, or they'll maybe cut me off and say, you know what, we know what the mortgage says. And then it's like, all right, that's your call. But if I had my way, I'm going through every document. I'm with you 100%.
Right.
We've had situations. So Dan and I met, so everyone knows that we met in a networking group and kind of hit it off. And as part of that group, on a weekly basis, Dan would, you know, say a story or vent about a certain fact pattern. And in addition to those fact patterns where someone's not explaining anything and just saying sign here, which is just not the right way to practice law, I know that you oftentimes have issues with someone who says, well, yeah, I'm a, you know, matrimonial attorney, but I'm handling this for my cousin. I'm from downstate, and that's not how we do it downstate. And so I'm going to make the next 2 months really difficult for you, Dan, because I'm a downstate attorney, and I'm going to try to apply downstate principles. So do you mind getting into that a little bit? Without raising your voice, because I know this is very, very, you know, upsetting to you.
I just took a few deep breaths.
Good.
I'm going to be okay. So exactly, and I've got... you know, I've done thousands of transactions. Some of the worst ones that I've had over the years happen to be with attorneys that are, they're doing favors, or they call them favors, for their friends or family. You know, they're not charging them. They're not in the area. So they're not familiar with how things go here. Or if I'm dealing with a litigation attorney, they just tend to make mountains out of molehills, and I'm like, this is not that big of an issue. Let's talk about it. It chews up a lot of time. I do have some right now where the attorneys are from downstate. This one in particular, she happens to be really nice, and she told me up front, she's like, look, not really familiar with what you guys do up there, but I want you to, you know, if you can, help me so that we can get through this without screaming at each other. And I thought that was a great way to start the file. I've had other transactions where the attorney is in New Jersey. They're licensed here so they can do the file, but, you know, they really have no business being involved. And I've said this many times in the meetings that we've had in that networking group is, you know, if I am ever in the position of needing, you know, brain surgery, you know, I'm not just going to see any old doctor just because they have a medical degree. I think I want to see a neurosurgeon because I'm pretty sure they're going to do a good job, and maybe not see a podiatrist because my feet are okay. And it's kind of the same thing. It's like, you know, if you're getting a divorce, don't ask me to help you because I don't know what I'm doing in that area of law. Know what you know what you don't know. And I think when you've got local real estate attorneys on either side, you know, you're setting yourself up for a more successful transaction.
Absolutely, Dan. And the same goes for estate planning and elder law. And you know, don't get us wrong. You don't have to use Herzog. I think we happen to be very good attorneys. But the point is, we want all sides of all fact patterns and all litigations and all real estate transactions and all estate administration issues. We want good attorneys all over the place. There's plenty of very good attorneys. Get ones that focus on the area you're dealing with. It ends up being really, really important. on the local side, that, you know, what I'm thinking about, Dan, just off the top of my head is I know from, you know, being downstate and being a practicing attorney down there earlier in my career, I know that the very beginning of the real estate transaction is totally different down there compared to up here, right? The idea of when does the client sign a agreement to buy a home? Do they sign it before the attorney reviews it? Do they sign it after? Is there an agreement on price and principal? And then attorneys negotiate the agreement that will be signed. Or is there an agreement already and then a review period? You know, are we doing riders to the purchase agreement or not? And, you know, nothing against downstate attorneys. I used to be one, right? But you're going to also say, well, that upstate attorney, what does he know? What does she know? I'm going to, you know, show off to my cousin here and flex a little bit and make Dan Glasser's day real difficult when it really is unnecessary. And so if you think you're hearing two different things, like, oh, wait a minute, Dan's going to go through every document, and that may take longer, but we're kind of against an attorney that doesn't know what they're doing, making things take longer. One is actually practicing law and representing your clients and making sure that they're informed. The other one is like incompetence. And so there's a difference there. So you kind of have some high standards as you're, you know, looking at a different attorneys and make sure they're going to represent your interests as much as possible.
Right.
We'd love for you to be our first caller. Yeah, I'm sorry, go ahead.
I was going to say a lot of your potential clients, they call local attorneys for fee shopping. And the fees can range. I mean, anywhere from $400 to $1,200. And, you know, if someone calls me and just says, what do you charge? I go through everything that we do in a transaction and what the fee covers. And then after about 5 minutes, I tell them what the charge is. So that they understand everything involved, because you know, sure, you can spend $400 on a transaction with another attorney. Maybe that attorney doesn't get back to you as quickly as you'd like them to. You might not hear from them for over a week. So you know, you get what you pay for. Again, it's just doing everything we can to set the transaction up for success. We like happy clients.
We do. You can be our first caller by calling 518-476-5900. If you're thinking, you know what, I don't need a call. I need Dan to be my real estate attorney. You can call our office at 518-465-7581 or email us at info@herzoglaw.com. Dan, we just had a week of webinars. We called it Webinar Week. And ranging from the normal topics you would hear on the radio during our program, so things like aging in place, you know, top 10 reasons to create an estate plan. Yesterday I presented on Medicaid and estate planning myths, so common misconceptions about how our world works, you know, will avoids probate, that kind of thing, which is obviously not true. And what was funny about the myth presentation is that a lot of them are partially true. As an example, one of them was, I can give all my money to my kids and qualify for Medicaid. And that's actually 100% true. That's not really a myth. That is true. That's also kind of the worst idea in the world. But the idea is if you give money away and you don't have it anymore and enough time goes by, the look-back period, right, you will qualify for Medicaid, because when you do have needs, you don't have any money. Who's got your money? Your kids do. And in general, we don't like that very much. We would greatly advocate that you do a trust or some other arrangement. And the reason why is because trusts are its own entity. They don't get divorced. They don't have creditors that sue them. They don't die like unfortunately, other people may do. And one of the goals that we have when we're doing planning is to make sure that you still control your money. And one of the worst ways to control your money is to give it all away at the outset in a way where you don't control getting it back. In the case of the trusts, you do. We also started to discuss this new power of attorney form that is now the law of the land in New York. And I don't know if you've had a chance to look at it, Dan, but it's a shorter version of the previous power of attorney. Have you seen it yet?
I have.
So for our clients out there, you're probably going to ask yourself, do I need to come in to get a new power of attorney? And for the vast majority of our clients, I think the answer is going to be no. Okay. The old form is grandfathered in if your power of attorney was signed before, I think, June 13th or so. You're all set. That power of attorney will still be something that will work if you go to the bank. If you have a power of attorney that's dated, you know, tomorrow, it's going to need to be the new form as opposed to the old form. That's good to know. Every now and then we have clients who come in, say, no, I don't need a power of attorney. Here is my current power of attorney. And it's amazing, Dan. It'll be dated, you know, 2 years ago, and the form is the form from 12 years ago. And it's because they, you know, found something online and didn't kind of look very carefully. The big change on the power of attorney is not in the in the contents of it. It's more in how the contents are divided. There used to be a section called the statutory gifts rider. Basically, if you wanted your agents to be able to make gifts or be able to put more things in your trust, which is a form of gift, if we wanted them to be able to do some relatively complicated last-second planning, New York was very worried your agents would take all your money, and they required a separate section called a gifting rider, and that gifting rider would need one, two, or three initials. It would need two witnesses and another signature from the client. The current new form, right? It is the current form right now. Will require two witnesses, but it won't require that separate section. It will actually allow us in the body of the main power of attorney to put whatever powers we want to do when it comes to gifting. So we just had a couple meetings in the office finalizing the language. If you're a new client, expect to see that new power of attorney. If you're an old client, we will look at your documents in the normal course of business. So, you know, we want to see you every couple of years just to see how you're doing, see if you're properly funding your trust, whether or not, you know, you need to go from a will to a trust, whether or not we need to change your documents anyway. Probably that's the right time. You know, your kid moved, we want to update their address. Your daughter is no longer married, we're going to update her last name. That might be a good time to just get the new power of attorney done to make sure that, you know, some bank isn't going to give you a hard time because it's not perfectly the new form. They may not know the old forms were grandfathered in. I expect that there'll be a lot of confusion, Dan, and maybe some stalled closings when the wrong power of attorney is used and the person you're sitting next to is not your client, it's the agent for your client. I'm sure that'll be pretty messy if we don't have the right form of power of attorney.
I agree. You know, even with the other documents that are signed for closings, because sellers, what has been common recently is sellers would sign their documents in advance of the closing, which is perfectly fine. And then the attorney would bring those to the closing, and then I look at them, and I'm like, well, this form is not the current form being accepted by the county clerk's office. This was a form that was used 8 years ago. Closing comes to a screeching halt because we need, you know, the most current document. So, and again, it just comes, it brings up the importance of preparation. I call it P to the fifth power. You know, prior preparation prevents poor performance, patent pending.
I thought there used to be one other P in there. Maybe I'm wrong.
Well, then it's not P to the fifth power. Now you're talking P to the sixth power.
Yeah. Dan, I know we got a couple minutes before the break, but let's stick on this power of attorney and real estate for a moment. So when someone's buying property, particularly when they have financing, right, you're always going to advocate for there to be title insurance. The lender will require it. If the county clerk doesn't record a deed, if they throw it back because the power of attorney was wrong, right, or there was something wrong with one of the transfer tax forms, what's the level of urgency in getting that fixed? What's the panic level in your brain when you hear from a county clerk that a deed is being bounced back because the power of attorney is not up to snuff?
Well, yeah, I mean, naturally, I think your heart skips a beat. You know, you're like, well, what's the reason? Sometimes, you know, it might be something like, well, your recordings are like a dollar short. Okay. Not a big deal. You know, if someone missed a signature, that is a big deal. You know, and the county clerk will spell out why it was rejected. Maybe there's missing language. But the real estate department at Herzog does a thorough check of documents before the closing to make sure that, you know, they are accurate. And before, because I'm the one that sends in the documents to the county clerk's office, before they're recorded, I go through them again to make sure, because I don't want the documents to get kicked back. You know, the documents, it's important that they get on record ASAP. So I check them again before they're recorded, and I check them before I leave the closing table to make sure everything is signed where it's supposed to be signed and that everything is filled out properly. Am I perfect? No. but I think it's important to check everything over to avoid any, you know, issues that could waste time and money.
Dan, I know that through a power of attorney, you could even be an agent for a client. Have you ever been agent for a client to sign some documents?
Beyond, I have.
You know, I know. Yeah.
Yeah, it was about 10 years ago. But, I mean, for sellers, what we do now is we just make arrangements with them to sign all the documents for the closing. There's probably 8 or 9 things that they would need to sign. You know, so sometimes they'll say, well, you can be my power of attorney, which is fine. So we're still going to have to make arrangements for you to sign the power of attorney in front of a notary. So if we're going to do that, why don't you just sign, you know, the 7 or so other papers, and then you'll save some money because the power of attorney won't have to be recorded. So you save about, you know, $100 there. That's usually the way we do it now.
And, of course, if you're going to be using a power of attorney, you know, and it might be, you know, wife is going to sign for husband because he's unavailable. A lot of times we have real estate transactions and, you know, where our worlds collide, someone's not doing very well, right? Someone's in the hospital, someone's in a nursing home, now it's time to sell a piece of property. Oftentimes we're going to have an agent signing for that grandpa, grandma, whoever it is. You need the original power of attorney. There's probably going to be something signed saying that's still in full force and effect. They're not just taking your word for it, that here's a copy of a power of attorney. And that's just one other document that can stall a closing if it's not presented properly with, you know, being an original and all.
Very true. Original is required at closing, and you're right. There would be an affidavit signed for the title company that the power of attorney is still in full force and effect. There's no power that's been revoked, and the grantor is still alive.
Dan, Dave?
Ben?
We are at the bottom of the hour. We're going to take our break right here. We'll be back with the second half of the Herzog Law Firm's Estate Medicaid Planning Hour coming up right after this.
You've been listening to the Estate and Medicaid Planning Hour with the Herzog Law Firm. Join us every week to learn more about protecting the assets you've worked hard for, options available for Medicaid planning, and more. With offices located in Corporate Woods in Albany, West Harrison Street in Saratoga Springs, Executive Woods in Clifton Park, and Flatbush Road in Kingston. Our attorneys are here to help you. If you'd like to schedule an appointment to speak with David, Jane Marie Harry, or Debbie, please call us during normal business hours, Monday through Friday, 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. To contact us at our Albany office, call 518-465-7581. Our Saratoga Springs office at 518-581-8131. Our Clifton Park office at 518-952-4010. And our Kingston office at 845-338-6405. Let the Herzog Law Firm help you navigate a plan that works for you and your family. Now back to the Estate and Medicaid Planning Hour with the Herzog Law Firm.
Good morning. We're back. My name is Dave Kabikian.
And I am Dan Glasser.
Dan and I are two of the attorneys at Herzog, and as I said in the first half hour, some combination of us is here every weekend talking about estate planning and elder law. When Dan's here, you better believe we're going to talk about real estate. And we'd love for you to be our first caller by calling 518-476-5900. And as always, our number in the office, 518-465-7581, if you'd like to schedule some time with Dan or myself, Debbie, Jane Marie, or Harry. Dan, we went through a lot of really important real estate. I would suspect that if I'm an attorney that doesn't practice real estate and I'm from downstate and I was somehow listening to this on my way to a closing or preparing for a closing next week, I'd probably be a little upset with what I heard, because we're kind of recommending people use actual real estate attorneys for their actual real estate transactions and actual, you know, local attorneys for their local transactions. All really important things.
Agreed. It is important. They say buy local. So
absolutely. We're just buy local. And you are organic, are you not?
Yes, 100%.
Good. And gluten-free, I hope. Dan, I want to bring something up, and I maybe invented something. I'm going to call it the three P's of trust funding. You have the five or six P's of whatever that was. I had three P's of trust funding. Okay. And the three P's, I'm not going to like do this thing where I slowly draw out the three, because normally what happens is someone calls just as I'm about to say the second P and then we lose track. The three P's are avoid probate, protect your assets, and peace of mind. Okay. And I'm going to jump on the probate one because I have a fact pattern that you will not believe. This is 100% true. Okay. So, we had, a client passed away, this past week, or she passed away 2 weeks ago. Her, one of her nieces came in and said, my aunt passed away. I'm executor on her will. I am trustee of her trust. What do we need to do? And so as normal, we meet with you know, the executor or next of kin, and we get some information from them. We give them some information in terms of what assets we knew about, how they were titled, whether there's beneficiaries or not. So we could figure out, is this just terminating a trust? Really easy. Or do we have to go through probate? Do we have to petition the court to be able to deal with some assets? And as it turned out, even though this client had a trust, she had about $45,000 outside of the trust in accounts that did not have beneficiaries and did not have joint owners. So that means that there's $45,000 that will never be touched until someone is authorized by the state of New York to touch it, an executor or an administrator, depending on whether there's a will or not. There is a will. The will says give everything to the trust, which is a normal will we do when we also have done a trust. So we have $45,000 that's supposed to go to the trust, and then the trust will distribute all the money in the trust to various beneficiaries and charities and this and that. Okay. So far, so good.
So far,
good. So when we are going to probate a will, and we've talked about this a bunch on the radio and in our webinars. When you're going to probate a will, the idea is we're proving to the court that the will was signed the right way. The right amount of witnesses were present, that there aren't crossouts all over the place and scribbles changing things, that the person who signed the will, we call them the testator, they had their mental faculties with them. So that's pretty much a slam dunk, but we have to notify people who would get money if there was no will. Those people are called distributees, okay? So as part of this probate process, to get niece authorized to do whatever the will says, we need to let everyone who would get money if there wasn't a will, we need to let them know they could contest this will, okay? So who are the distributees? Well, there's a statute that says who they are, and it's based on your family tree. And so if you have a spouse and you don't have kids, well, everything goes to your spouse. They would be an interested party. If you have kids and no spouse, it would be your kids. If we only have grandkids, it would be your grandkids. This client who passed away did not have a spouse, did not have children. So the next place to go would be your parents. Now, I should let you know, this client who passed away was 93. So her parents aren't alive. Okay. The next step from parents would be your aunts and uncles, the siblings of your parents. Okay. And by the way, this client also didn't have any siblings. So we skipped that level as well. So we actually ended up going up to grandparents. 93-year-old, obviously grandparents not around, right? Well, we need to split up that $50,000. Technically, one half would go to the paternal side, okay? One half would go to the maternal side, okay? So far, so good, Dan. I still have you.
So far.
I haven't heard any breathing in a while.
I'm a sponge. I'm taking all this in.
Okay. So if now we're at the uncles and aunts. Right, that's who we're looking at. Again, all these uncles and aunts have passed away because this is a 93-year-old. So then we're looking at cousins. Now, this is where the math gets heavy for a moment because I just want to make everyone understand how ridiculous this is. This is the whole point of the conversation, is the absolute sheer waste of everything. So we have 50 grand or so that we're worried about. We have one half. Well, we know it's all going to a trust, but we need to get sign-off from people who would get money if there wasn't a trust. And the people who would get money based on this family tree end up being the first cousins of this woman. However, most of those first cousins are no longer alive as well because she was 93. So we get to the children of first cousins. And without getting too into the how many kids everyone has, but these were big families, we will need to contact, unless the court advises us otherwise, we're going to need to get signatures from people who would be entitled to 0.47% of an estate, okay? And when that estate's $50,000 and it's 0.47%, we're getting close to the mailing costing more than the money they're signing off on. And unfortunately, when you're living in a world where there's probate and people have to go through probate, the law is the law, right? We're going to cross our fingers that when we show the court that all these other people have passed away and we've provided date of death, and we've gone on ancestry.com, and we've done all the public record searches, that they will say, you know what, you can just take that 45 grand and throw it into the trust. But that's going to be a lot of work, Dan, and one of the most important things about funding your trust and the reasons why we want you to fund your trust is because whatever's in your trust avoids probate automatically. It's in your trust. It's not owned by the person who dies, thus it avoids probate. And where it really can bite us is where we have a fact pattern like this, or a much easier version of this, because no matter what, we got to go through court. We got to spend a couple $1,000s. Between filing fees and attorney's fees to get all the proper documents into court. So, I mean, I couldn't believe when this happened, I met with one of our paralegals, Janice, who does nothing but estate administration, and I can't repeat the word she said when I laid this all out to her, because she already was, you know, three steps ahead of me like she normally is. So the first P of trust funding is avoid probate. Are you there, Dan?
I'm on the edge of my seat, Dave, waiting for the second P.
Well, I'm waiting for our first caller at 518-476-5900. But in the absence of said caller, I'm just going to go right into the second P, Dan. I'm not even going to waste any time. I'm going for it.
Sorry.
So the next P is a little easier. The idea and for most people, when they do a trust, the type of trust they do is going to be one of those Medicaid asset protection trusts. And you can't spell Medicaid asset protection trust without the word protection. And that's the second P. We can only protect what's been in the trust for a certain amount of time, guys. And, you know, that's why you met with us in the first place or met with whatever estate planning attorney you're using, right? The idea is you realize that, you know, one day everything ends, and between now and then we want to protect assets so that we leave to whoever and whatever is important to us as much as possible. The biggest threat to that happening, the biggest threat to your plan, is not going to be probate. I know I just said really bad things about probate. That's several thousand dollars. It's more of a headache. It's more of a time issue. It's more of a, man, this was really not necessary issue when it comes to probate. The biggest threat to your plan is going to be that the pie you're leaving to people is going to be a lot smaller than it should have been. Why? Because we had lots of long-term care expenses, and we ended up not protecting our assets along the way. I tell people all the time, I'm going to tell you right now, Dan, protection takes time. You can instantly unprotect your money if you feel like it. So I want you to liberally put money in your trust, knowing that you're going to be able to get money out if you need it. Now, I don't want to put every dollar in, right? We're not saying protect everything. Live your life and enjoy. We can even budget this out and at the end of the day, you still control your money and you can still get your money. But I don't think you need $200,000 in a money market account in your name anymore. I half jokingly say, Dan, unless we're prepared to pay a ransom real soon, we don't need that kind of money. And it sounds like a better idea to me to put more money in your trust. Now, you know, we don't get anything. Herzog, we don't get anything if you put more money in your trust or not. This is not self-serving at all. I mean, in fact, it might be the opposite, because if we do this properly, if we have beneficiaries on the money we leave out of the trust, we're going to avoid probate. That's great, right? So we just saved you money there. That, you know, one of the things we want to do in general, look, we don't know if you're going to have long-term care needs. I don't know how, my client got to 93. I would sign up for 93 right now. I have no idea how my life will shake out. I do know that, you know, one day it'll end. So let's avoid probate. Let's guarantee that. Let's properly fund the trust to do that. But let's also have an eye towards living. I'd like to live more. Let's protect our assets. And so that way, you know, my two kids or my grandkids or whatever, the lay of land is when I'm gone, I want to make sure that they're, you know, all my hard work was protected for them.
Dave, Dan.
Second. Yep.
I've written down protection, so we go back to that, but we do have a caller. So we'd like to say good morning to Paul in Ballston Spa.
Hey, Paul.
Good morning. My question is, if you have an IRA account and that doesn't go into the trust, how do you protect that from probate?
That's a good question. Don't hang up. I want to keep talking with you. So your IRA has a beneficiary.
Correct.
Right. And that's the key. So we're not saying put everything in the trust or that a trust is the only way to avoid probate. What, you know, the flaw in what my client had was not that she didn't put everything in the trust. It's that the three things that she left out of the trust, she didn't have a beneficiary on it. One of the accounts actually had niece as power of attorney, she's power of attorney. That means she can touch the money. Yeah, she could have up until the moment that aunt passed away, because when a death occurs, when the principal dies, the power of attorney is over. it's a document for during your life. So where there's beneficiaries, we're going to avoid probate. So IRAs, bank accounts could be TOD or POD, transfer on death or pay on death. Brokerage accounts have beneficiaries. Life insurance, of course, has beneficiaries. You know, a lot of married couples, when one spouse dies, normally there's no probate, many times, in fact. And sometimes when we're meeting with clients, they'll say something like, well, when my dad died, there was no need for probate. Why are you making a big deal out of probate? And I'll say, well, that was because your mom was still alive and they had, you know, co-titled assets, or mom was beneficiary of dad's things. So when it comes to an IRA, it's going to avoid probate because you have a beneficiary on it. Okay. Now, it gets a slightly more complicated because beneficiaries are not the only thing that's important. Okay, beneficiaries help us avoid probate, but the most important thing is going to be whatever your plan is. So, as an example, and I'll pick on Dan for a moment. Dan, you have life insurance, right?
I do.
And you have several children, do you not?
A few of them.
So, Dan, I'm not going to ask you who you have as a backup beneficiary to your wife. Your wife is your beneficiary on your life insurance. I'm not going to ask you who your backups are, but I'm going to make sure that everyone out there knows your backups should not be your children, because your children are young. And if you name them as a beneficiary on something, they actually get that money. And, you know, are they going to... How old is your youngest, Dan?
Seven.
Seven. So if, God forbid, something happened to you and your wife on date night, a seven-year-old isn't going to put Toys R Us back in business. That's not going to happen, right? Money will be held for him if you had him as a beneficiary on life insurance. But the problem is he's going to turn 18 one day and, spend the next 11 years without parents, and maybe he won't do the right thing with that money when he gets it. So getting back to your call, an IRA avoids probate because you have a beneficiary on it. That doesn't mean that you should have a beneficiary on everything and just call it a day, because sometimes it's more nuanced, right? For me, I have rules for when my kids get money, because they're two and they're about to be eight. So I want to make sure we have a document with pages and pages of language, as opposed to just the beneficiary designation like there is on an IRA, which is a name and a percentage. Right? Sometimes we need to get a little more complicated than that. Sometimes the name and a percentage gets it done perfectly because our kids are older. So IRAs avoid probate because of a beneficiary. Now, the other part of it, that other P, the protection part, IRAs don't go in your trust. They do not go in your trust. And that's okay, because they avoid probate already because there's a beneficiary. And number two, if we apply for Medicaid one day for someone, Medicaid won't look at that IRA as a big pile of money. Don't be concerned with those distributions you should be taking from the IRA. They're concerned with income that comes from the IRA. So when it comes to IRAs, you're in really good shape.
One other question.
Sure.
Another question?
Yeah, go ahead.
If one of the spouses die and you have a savings account, should you put one of your children on that savings account so that it passes to them without probate?
I think that's definitely a very good option, for sure. There's different ways to do that. You can add someone for convenience purposes, or you could do something with the intent that they will get that money. And, the nuance to it, I guess, depends on how many kids you have and what your overall plan is. But yeah, I really, really hate probate. I can't emphasize it enough. And having a beneficiary on an account, TOD, POD, or adding a name to an account, where it's with rights of survivorship, that's a great way to do it. I just want it to be, it's a piece of the rest of the puzzle. So if your overall plan is to leave things evenly to four kids, and you're going to name one kid on the bank account only, right, we want to make sure that that child knows they're going to be splitting that money with the other three. Now, legally, they're not going to be obligated to do so. Do we want to name all four kids? That we might have to, right? It's all part of the puzzle. But at a minimum, I want that account to avoid probate. In fact, that fact pattern I was just talking about with the 93-year-old, it was a savings account. so she had a checking account, a savings account, and then one other, a couple of shares of stock. But that savings account, right, she could have easily done TOD, POD. She could have actually retitled the account and put it in her trust if she wanted to. That could have happened, you know, a week before she passed away, because we weren't worried about a look-back period. It would just be about avoiding probate. So absolutely, I would consider that.
How about if you have one of your children on your savings account and they end up in a financial problem? Can the people that are looking for money from your children tap that savings account?
Well, so that's kind of the reason why we don't want to add people to accounts, and we'd rather have beneficiaries, or we'd rather have money in a trust, because in the case of adding kids as just beneficiaries, as a beneficiary, you don't get anything, right? You don't get anything until, you know, you pass away, right? When you pass away, that's when people would get, you know, people who are transfer on death would get money. If you add someone as a joint owner, they don't really own that money. They didn't contribute anything to it, but, you know, it's technically one of their assets. Technically, right? Their name's on the bank account. So we want to make sure that money will be protected. In the case of trusts, wait a minute, I have my kids as beneficiaries on my trust, or they're my trustee. So in the trust scenario, you always have the ability of changing who your beneficiaries are or who your trustee is. So they're never vested as owners. So not just creditors, but death, divorce, it won't impact things when your kids are beneficiaries or when they're associated with your trust. When we're making them co-owners, it's going to impact things. And thanks so much for your call. Dan, what I'd like to do is actually turn this into a life estate question as well, because a lot of times people will select a life estate as a way to protect their home and avoid probate. And that's a wonderful way to do it. I did that for my grandfather, okay? But there's very big negatives to that, because when you do a life estate deed and you add your kids, right, you end up deeding your house to the kids subject to your life use. Your kids' creditors can touch their assets. Their assets include your home. Now, you're not going to get kicked out because you have a life use, but the value of your home, right, that's in question then when you die, because during your life we had owners, vested owners, who, you know, have creditors, and bad things happen to them. We've had situations, unfortunately, where someone adds their child on a deed, and they do this life estate deed, and then unfortunately that child passes away, and now the co-owner of the property is grandkids, and they may not be of age. What are your thoughts on life estate deeds, Dan?
I actually have not seen too many of those recently. You know, the one that I did see one yesterday, as a matter of fact, and, you know, when we see that in a title search, we either need that person to sign off on the deed, or we need proof of death. So it's just, you know, crossing T's for a title search. But I haven't seen too many of them lately.
Yeah, I guess that would make sense. Usually if you know, someone's selling, maybe it used to be a life estate deed. Mom passed away finally, and now the kids are deciding what to do with the house. They say, we're going to sell the house. In that instance, your client is the kids, right? Because they now own 100% of the property. And somewhere in that, you know, what you'll provide to the title company, exactly as you said, a death certificate. You know, there's a lot of different ways to get the job done. And so, you know, we got to be careful ourselves. We're not, you know, rah, 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 you got to do a trust and that's it. Every fact pattern is different. I mean, I could have very easily done a free trust for my grandfather. I would not have charged him, believe me. But it just didn't make sense in the fact pattern. It was, my mom was an only child. My grandpa was in his 90s. He was never going to be leaving that home, so we weren't going to have to worry about selling it during his life. You know, we only have a couple minutes left here, but there are some drawbacks to things like life estate deeds, because upon a sale, when mom is still alive, it gets quite confusing, because mom didn't own the whole house. She owned the life estate. Kids owned more of the house than mom did, in fact, the way the math shakes out. And sometimes, people do a life estate deed a little too young. And then they want to sell their home, and someone needs to tell them, well, we need everyone to sign off on selling the home. And believe it or not, from the proceeds, the kids are entitled to most of the proceeds because they own the majority of the home at that point. And that's it should work out because everyone should get along. It doesn't always work out that way, though. We say all the time, Dan, we don't plan for sunny days. It's never a sunny day in Herzog Law Firm, unfortunately. We always have to plan for the rainy days.
Mm. And sometimes snow.
Yeah. Well, look at when you're adding some provisions to a real estate contract, those provisions you're adding aren't because you're expecting those bad things to happen. It's because they might. And
right.
And other attorneys that don't practice real estate law are going to say, look at this jerk. All these provisions making a big deal for no reason, but you're just protecting your client just in case foreseeable things, unlikely, but foreseeable, just in case those things actually happen.
That's such a great point because I often get that response when I send out my attorney approval letter. I hope they're not calling me a jerk. I hope it's more like, well, this attorney is being quite thorough, and I admire him for that. That's the reaction.
Yeah. Well, or you want them to basically take your provision so they use it in the future, because why not? It's good language.
I'm a trendsetter.
So, Dan, we only have a couple minutes left. I know that you're going to be going on vacation. I'm assuming that the closing idea will be just fine. I hope your kids have a wonderful time on vacation. I don't know if everyone needs all the details of where you're going, but much.
Do you hope I have a good time too?
I know you're going to have a good time. You're going to be with your kids, and you're not going to be working. You're going to be just fine.
Oh, thank you.
I hope the weather cooperates and so on.
Yeah, it looks like it's going to be very warm there, so we're excited.
Have a great week, guys. Take care.
Thank you for listening to the Estate and Medicaid Planning Hour with the Herzog Law Firm. For more information on their services, please visit herzoglaw.com. If you'd like to speak with one of their attorneys, please contact the Albany office at 518-465-7581, the Saratoga office at 518-581-8131, or their Kingston office at 845-338-6405.